You know, a few weeks ago, my dad turned 70 years old, and I was talking to him on the phone. He still lives back in Michigan where I grew up. And he was doing some genuflecting, you know, turning 70. That's a big milestone. And I was asking him, you know, Dad, you still playing hoops? You know, we're a big basketball family. And my dad has just kept playing pickup basketball like this, you know, his whole life, well into his 50s, 60s, and now turning 70. And he was like, yeah, you know, in my head, I don't feel 70 years old, you know, so I'm still showing up. He'll still show up at like LA Fitness. And he's like, yeah, you know, the only thing that's different is the young guys, they don't pick me up for pickup games. They're like, yeah, we're not picking up the old guy. So he's like, I do get reminders that I'm 70 years old. I feel it in my body the next day. And to some degree, I'm not quite there yet. Like, I can relate to my dad on that front. I turned 42 at the end of the month. I'm just letting you know, you can make your cards and checks out. You know, we've got a QR code in the bulletin. No, we don't. I'm just joking. And I can kind of resonate with my dad a little bit, not in that same way. Most days, I feel in my head like I'm still in my 20s. A couple of reminders that I wasn't, though, this week. So I still play basketball from time to time, and I went out to my local Y and was playing pickup ball with some younger guys. And, you know, as the kids would say, I was in my bag. You know, I still got it a little bit. And afterwards, they're saying, hey, you know, did you play in college? And I was like, yeah, I played in college. But, you know, that was, and I couldn't believe the words that came out of my mouth. I was like, but that was 25 years ago. I was like, was it really that long ago? No, I cannot be that old. You know, also this week, I had the opportunity, I went and I spoke, I gave a lecture at a ministry school, a Bible school, and while there were some people my age and older there, it was primarily people in their early 20s. You know, so I'm talking about like theology and culture, and I'm using some references to things from, you know, my days. I grew up in the church. You know, so as an 80s, 90s kid, we had all of this kind of like Christian media and entertainment that was out there. And so sometimes I would just occasionally make reference to it, and I realized these people don't have any idea what I'm talking about. You know, I'm a passing mention of DC Talk, and they're like, what? What is that? Okay, raise your hand if you know what DC Talk, okay. All right. Okay, so I'm gonna quiz some of you on a few more just to see how many of you get kind of these references. You know, the 80s and 90s was kind of like the heyday of developing this ecosystem of Christian TV and movies and music. So raise your hand if you've heard of this. All right, I'm going to list off a few titles here. McGee and Me. Okay, all right, maybe 40% of the room here. How about Adventures in Odyssey? Oh, yeah, let's go. All right. So we already mentioned DC Talk. How about Salty? Yeah, okay, the singing. He was like a Barney, sort of, but he was a giant Bible. Like a giant Bible that sang songs from the Psalms. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, if this is your first Sunday here, don't leave. All right. Okay, I already mentioned DC Talk. What about Carmen? Okay, Carmen. Satan Bites the Dust, the champion, every possible children's church skit. Every kid's talent show in church had at least one Carmen song being acted out. Two of my favorites, though, that I really loved, and they stood out to me, and they actually really did. I'm joking here a little bit, but these two did make an impact on me as a kid. Two of my favorites were Superbook. All right, anybody ever watch Superbook? All right, the original, like, Christian anime. I was like, in the 80s? That's pretty wild. And the other one there on your right would be Hanna-Barbera's Greatest Adventures Stories from the Bible. And both of these shows kind of did the same thing. They were the same premise. So you have young people who somehow in like Superbook, the Bible would open up in, I think Christopher was his name's bedroom. And they'd be like taken through this portal back to Bible times. the two of them and are like a little robot sidekick, which was like, where did that come from? So they're living in the biblical stories, and it was the same idea with Derek, Margo, and Moki here. There was some portal that they would travel through, and then all of a sudden they're living through these Bible stories. It was actually a really great way for me as a kid to learn the Bible stories. And I found that the stories of the Bible that were told in Superbook and Hanna-Barbera's Greatest Adventures of the Bible, it really did resonate with me. The world of the Bible felt enchanted. It felt supernatural and magical. A God who parts seas, a God who empowered teenagers to slay giants, a God who spoke through mysterious dreams and visions, seemingly audible voices to prophets. It was scenes of Jesus casting out demons and raising the dead. You know, those were the kinds of stories that as a young boy, I found myself completely enamored with. And they rivaled anything that I had heard from the legends of King Arthur or The Lord of the Rings, or even my comic book, Superheroes. These were the kinds of stories. When I read the Bible and I heard these Bible stories, something in me said, that's the kind of story I want to be in. Like, I want to be like these kids. I want to live in that kind of world. Now, the church context I was raised in contributed to this sense of, like, I wanted to live in a story that was filled with supernatural occurrences like this. You know, I grew up in deeply, deeply charismatic context, Pentecostal context. You know, my mom, she grew up Roman Catholic, and our kind of gateway into like the world of more charismatic churches was she grew up Roman Catholic, but in her early adult years and college years, in the Detroit area, there was a Lutheran minister that was like holding revival meetings. And my mom's mom had a friend that was always over the house that she found rather cantankerous and pretty mean most of the time. And then all of a sudden, when she was coming over the house for a couple of weeks in a row, she noticed her mom's friend was suddenly nicer, kinder. She had this joy about her, and there was something different, and she started telling my mom and her sisters, yeah, well, I've been going over to this Lutheran church, this revival meeting that's been happening there, and my mom was just so shocked at how different this gal was. She was like, I'm going to go check it out. And she experienced a sense of the power of God there that she had not felt before, and it felt like the stories that she had heard her whole life, growing up in a Catholic mass and going to Catholic school, but she felt like she was seeing it, like she was seeing revival, miraculous healings, all sorts of stuff, and she felt so attracted to that. So when my mom and dad got married, they settled in a church that kind of really made that sort of stuff a big part of their life. So I grew up in that kind of environment where there was really the celebration of the miraculous and that, you know, you can do this sort of stuff. And that was most of my, formative years in the church. And then when I got into my early ministry years, those were the contexts that I was in. I was traveling the country, going, leading revival meetings as a worship pastor, worship leader, doing these conferences. And I saw things, y'all, that sometimes I still don't know what to make of. I've got stories to tell that, you know, I won't tell them here, but if you want to sit down and hear some wild stories, I got some wild stories to tell. And yet at the same time, right, like this was the sort of thing that I saw in the Bible, and yet I still struggled. I had this deep problem that I struggled with for most of my life. I did see a few stories in my real life that looked like the sort of thing I saw in Superbook. You know, I saw a few of those from time to time, but most of my life didn't feel all that supernatural. Most of my life didn't feel like some grand, awesome biblical story. Unexplained suffering still hit people in my charismatic and Pentecostal churches that seemed to hit people in other churches that didn't necessarily believe in all the stuff we believed. It still happened. At 19 or 20 years old, I had my like first foray into vocational ministry. I did a pastoral internship in our local charismatic church. I spent the first few months on the job visiting my former youth pastor in hospice who was dying of cancer and helping his wife, who was a dear friend of my mom, like plan the funeral in their early 50s. My youth pastor, as much as I wanted to, he wasn't raised from the dead at that funeral. I didn't hear while we were praying for him. I didn't hear the audible voice of God. I didn't see the stuff in Superbook happening. And I realized, even as all this stuff was happening, I was traveling all over the country and seeing these sorts of revival meetings, I found that most of my life actually wasn't filled with these kinds of burning bush experiences. I would wake up, I'd brush my teeth, I'd go to work, try to pay my bills, I'd figure out day by day how to stay married. I'd push my kids on the swings at the park when they were real young. I'd do some dishes after dinner. I'd stare at the pile of laundry that just never seems to go away. And I had this growing frustration that maybe I was doing something wrong. Like, most of my day didn't look like the biblical stories I'd fell in love with. Shouldn't my life be constantly miraculous? Shouldn't it be supernatural all the time? So, I had this really difficult time, you know, especially from like 2006 to 2008, when I was doing a lot of traveling all over the country, and I would come back home to normal life and feel increasingly just dissatisfied with it all. I don't know if I would say, like, I wouldn't have said at the time that God felt completely absent. But at the very least, in most of the mundane moments of my life, God felt muted. We've been going through the last few weeks a book that I didn't actually have a lot of familiarity with when I was young, the book of Ruth. And maybe as you've been going through together with us this book, you've noticed something conspicuously absent from the story of Ruth compared to most other Bible stories, especially those stories of the Old Testament. As we've gone through, maybe you've noticed, like, where's God speaking to prophets and seers? Where's the miraculous dreams and visions? Where's the parting of the Red Sea kind of miracles? Maybe you've noticed there's none of that in the book of Ruth. Old Testament scholar Grace Emerson notes that in the book of Ruth, compared to most other narratives of the Bible, the activity of God seems what she would call muted. She says this, quote, "At times, God seems not even in the shadows. And twice, significant events are attributed to chance." So you can see that in places like Ruth 2:3 and Ruth chapter 3, verse 18, where it seems like the author might be saying, this thing just kind of happened by chance accident. And you're like, what? Again, I don't remember much about Ruth as a kid, and I'm sure we talked about it, and it felt like the ways that Ruth was talked about was something like an Old Testament Hallmark movie. You know, here's the love story of Ruth and Boaz. I learned over the last 10 years how off that picture was, and I actually needed this book in ways that I didn't fully realize. I needed this book to help me see that when God feels muted, when he doesn't necessarily feel present in some strong, miraculous way, that his activity is working in the shadows of my own story and your story. And I needed to correct a misperception, and today we're going to spend our time in the book of Ruth here trying to correct a misperception we often have of what it means for God to be at work in the world. So first, I want to look at some clues, some contextual clues in the text that give us clear evidence that the author of Ruth is showing us that this book is not just an Old Testament Hallmark movie, so it's not doing that. God's activity may feel muted. There's no parting of the Red Sea. There's no burning bushes. None of that stuff in this story. But there are two places where the narrator of the book of Ruth states explicitly that God is the direct primary cause of events in this story, and they just so happen to bookend the story at the beginning of Ruth and at the end of Ruth. So let's see here at the beginning of Ruth where we see, if you would open up to Ruth chapter 1, we'll spend most of our time in Ruth 6, but I want to set these contextual clues for us. So we're looking at Ruth 1 verse 6 this morning, kind of do a little recap of where we came from. So Ruth 1, verse 6, When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. So here's the first mention of God's direct activity in the story. We could say God as a primary cause. God had come to the aid of his people, providing food for them. The Lord, Yahweh, he created the conditions through the provision of food in the midst of a famine for the stage and scene to be set for this unfolding drama. Now, I'm going to leave the second instance in which God is directly and explicitly mentioned as the direct cause, primary cause of something happening in Ruth's story. I'm going to leave that for Pastor Jay next week because it's in the final chapter of Ruth, and I don't want to spoil it completely. But it's interesting that these two mentions, and these are the only explicit mentions of God's direct activity in the story, bookend the story. So what we should see and we should take clearly is the author is intending to paint for us a picture in which God's active provision in the opening section of our story brings about the pathway for his redemptive activity that we will see in the conclusion of the story. So where should we look for God when God feels muted? When you have that unending pile of laundry that seems to consume so much of your week and your day, when you're filling out expense reports in your office cubicle and it doesn't seem like there's a burning bush there with you, where to look for God? First, I want to encourage you here. When God feels muted, we need to correct this misperception that God was just somehow like the creator that started creation and then kind of leaves it alone and like occasionally intervenes in miraculous ways. When God feels muted, remember that God did not just start creation and then occasionally intervenes with miracles. He is sustaining all things. So we kind of have this maybe more deist version of God that has crept into much of our theology. This notion that, yes, God created all things, awesome, and then he kind of like pressed the start button on this creation machine, and then from time to time when things go wrong, he steps in and intervenes. That is not the biblical portrayal of God that we get from Scripture, and certainly not in the book of Ruth. What we see here in Ruth is that God has created the conditions for this story to unfold. He has set the stage, and he is holding it all together, sustaining all things. You know, they didn't have in the book of Ruth the complete picture yet of the role of the Son of Christ in that story. But we do know in the New Testament that we have this picture from Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3 that shows this exact idea. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. Right now, take note of this, be aware of this. This present moment, the breath that fills your lungs, the laws of physics that are running as they should, this whole moment right now is being sustained by the word of God. It is being held together right now by God. So it's not that just God started this and he kind of left it to run and then occasionally he shows up and intervenes. Right now he is holding it together. Right now it is being sustained. The second place, and this will be where we spend the majority of our focus, because this is where the story of Ruth spends the majority of its focus. When God feels muted, the other insight that the book of Ruth gives us is when God feels muted and you're like, where are you? We should look for the activity of redemption through mundane mediators of his grace. It may not always be. Maybe occasionally you might have the burning bush episode in your life. And those do happen. But most of your life, the redemptive activity of God happens through mundane mediators of his grace. Thus far, Pastor Jay, in the last several weeks, he helped us see how God's redemptive activity has been mediated through the faithfulness of Ruth to her mother-in-law, Naomi, who confessed several times that Naomi felt like she was abandoned by God. So we can see Ruth as a mundane mediator of redemption in Ruth 1 and Ruth 2. Last week, Pastor Jay introduced us to Boaz. And here in Boaz, we met another mundane mediator of redemption. In what even appears to be in Ruth 2, again, this is one of the places where it seems almost like the text is saying it was a random chance encounter that Ruth just so happened to end up in the same field that Boaz owned and watched over. It seems like a chance encounter. We know that it's more than that. Ruth ends up working in the field of Boaz. Boaz takes note of Ruth and even that being a Moabite, that Ruth is living out covenant faithfulness to God. I'm so glad Jay brought this up because this kind of deprograms us from the kind of like Hallmark movie framing for this story. Pastor Jay made explicit mention. The thing Boaz notices in Ruth 2 wasn't like, oh, this isn't a physically attractive woman, right? That's not in the text at all. This isn't just like some sort of Hallmark story. What he notices in this Moabite woman is her character. And that her character is making manifest the covenant faithfulness of God. He sees how Ruth is mediating God's redemptive activity to Naomi, and it stands out to him. Boaz takes note of that. He goes and blesses Ruth, and Ruth goes back at the end of a long day of work, right, and asks, well, where, you know, Naomi says, where did you end up working today? Whose field were you in? Who looked out for you? Who took care of you? And Ruth goes, it's this man, Boaz. He did it. I want you to notice Naomi's reply to Ruth in Ruth chapter 2, verse 20. So you can go from Ruth 1 to Ruth 2 before we get into Ruth 3 here. Ruth 2, 20. This is Naomi's reply when she heard this update. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers. Because Boaz was an extended family member of her deceased husband, Boaz was legally allowed to play an important role in their culture called being a guardian redeemer. A guardian redeemer. The Hebrew word here that you can see translated either as guardian redeemer, some translations would say kinsman redeemer, is goel. And that Hebrew word means literally one who redeems. So a guardian redeemer or a kinsman redeemer, this was somebody that was designated as a family protector. They stepped in and restored a relative's land, honor, or lineage when it was in danger. So remember, Naomi's husband had died, and their family had had land lost. God, Naomi's asking, where are you in this? She even feels abandoned and forsaken. So where is the redemptive activity of God in Naomi's life? It's in Ruth. It's in the mundane faithfulness of Ruth. Ruth's husband had died as well. She had no heir to carry on the family name. God, where are you in Ruth's life? He's in the mundane faithfulness of Boaz. Which brings us to Ruth chapter 3. So we're going to read some of this together, and I'm warning you, this chapter is going to feel maybe the most foreign and strange. The customs here are completely foreign to us. Let's start off here in verse 1. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law Naomi said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for. Now Boaz, with whose woman you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight, he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." So let me pause you right there. So she does this. It's the middle of the night. Boaz feels or hears something and is startled. Jump down to verse 9. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." And I want you to note, I think Pastor Jay also hinted at this last week, the phrase "spread your cloak" in Hebrew literally means, it's the same thing as saying "spread your wings." It's the same word Boaz had used earlier in chapter 2. when blessing Ruth for taking refuge under God's wings. It's the same thing. So let's jump down here to verse 10. We'll keep reading. "The Lord bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true I am a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good. Let him redeem you. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here to morning." In essence, Boaz says to her, you know, this is a strange custom to us, but it's a normal custom of saying, hey, I want you to be my guardian redeemer. I want you to step in and take this role. But notice, Boaz, this incredible character in Boaz, he goes, I would love to do that. But in the legal pecking order of how this thing works, there's actually someone that outranks me. So I am of such a man of character that I would love to do this, but I got to do it right. There might be someone else. They got dibs on stepping into this role. I'm going to check in with them, okay? I'm going to check in with them first. But before you go home, he ends up sending her home with 6 measures of barley to take back to Naomi. Boaz and his character is the medium of God's faithfulness to Ruth. So where is God in the middle of this story, this family story filled with pain and struggle? God has not only set the stage, he's not only sustaining the conditions, but we find God's activity in the character of the characters in this story. We find in the characters of this story, God is made present as they live in harmony with the character of God. God has given Boaz, he gave him the blessing of provision. And by using that provision well and in keeping with God's character, he is participating in the redemptive activity of God. By using the provision he was blessed with, to not hoard it for himself, but to bless someone else with. Now, I don't want to spoil the end of the story that Pastor Jay is going to focus on next week, but I'll give you a little hint. Some of you already know how this is going to go, right? This movie, this story has been out for a few thousand years, so I think it's okay for me to spoil part of the end of it, all right? Ruth and Boaz become the great-grandparents of King David. Their mundane story is the necessary prequel to that miraculous story. My favorite Hanna-Barbera version of the Bible story was the David and Goliath one, which is incredible, miraculous, it's awesome. We've been watching this kind of like modernized version of that story. They take a lot of creative liberties in a show called House of David. My wife and daughter have been watching. And I just so love that story. It's so miraculous. But that miraculous story doesn't happen without the mundane faithfulness of Ruth and Boaz. Their mundane story is the necessary prequel to that miraculous story. And of course, boy, this is what gets even more fascinating about this. Even David's miraculous story of his journey to become king of Israel is the prequel to an even more important miraculous story, the birth of Jesus as the descendant of David, who becomes the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. It is Ruth and Boaz in their day-to-day faithfulness. It is the conformity of their character to God's work of redemption that changes the course of history. Though they probably died having no idea of what role they played in this huge, massive, cosmic story, they played a role in bringing about the Christ. Whoa. Now, I want to ask you something here. Is it possible that your mundane story, your boring day-to-day faithfulness, is a necessary prequel to a future grand miraculous story that God's doing? Some of you that showed up yesterday with your fans and your dehumidifiers, mundane, boring faithfulness, you set about the preconditions for us to be able to get together and worship here this morning. You know, you're working on the boilers, all that. You know, who knows what person came here this morning, maybe for the first time, and their life is completely changed. Mundane, boring, faithfulness. God's extraordinary story is most often mediated through ordinary faithfulness. I want to encourage you. Yes, you are called to live in a grand cosmic redemption story. God is doing something in all of creation that seems beyond our wildest imagination. Some days you will see burning bushes. You may have this overwhelming felt sense of God's nearness. You may see miraculous things. Other days you're on your billionth load of laundry. You're cleaning your baby's poopy diaper. You're sitting in a cubicle filling out spreadsheets. You're sitting bedside with a family member in hospice. And nothing quite seems like it's a pillar of fire or Lazarus coming out of a tomb. And you're going, where are you, God? You know, a few weeks ago, I was asking my kids at the end of their like school day, I was like, how did your day go? And they said something to me in their like Gen Z, Gen Alpha language I had to decode, right? They're like, well, it just felt like a filler episode. It's like, can you unpack that for me? A filler episode. Yeah, you know, Dad, like when you're like binging a series on Netflix or something, and you got the major like season finales that have all of the stuff coming together, but then you also have these like filler episodes, right? I'm like, oh, I get what you mean. But you know what happens in filler episodes if the story's really good? The filler episode is the character building episode, right? It's where you develop a sense of like your connection to this character. And if the story is really, really good, it has a big payoff in the end that doesn't happen. You don't feel that same sense of connection without the filler episodes. Much of your life is going to be filler episodes, and that's okay. But I want you to consider that maybe you could reframe those filler episodes as, God, I believe in my little slice of life, you're doing something to bring about the redemption of all of the cosmos. I don't know what role I'm playing in that. It might be simple faithfulness, but I know you're setting the world right. And I'm playing some little role in that. So maybe when you feel like God is muted, I want you to look for two things. And as we invite the worship team to come up here, I want you to look for two things. I want you to consider reframing what's going on as God not, you know, when you see the burning bushes stuff that like, oh, God showed up. And the other times when you're doing your laundry and cleaning diapers that he's not there. The first thing I want you to remember is God is sustaining that moment. He is holding it together by his powerful word through his son. And the second thing I want you to look for is in the people around you. Look for the people in your life. You know, I think Mr. Rogers once said, look for the helpers, you know, when you feel worried. Look for the helpers. Look for the people in your life that are just participating in the mundane faithfulness and goodness of God. And lastly, this is the charge I have for you, is I want to encourage all of you, let your character continually be shaped by God's redemptive activity so that your character looks more and more like the character of Christ, so that you, in your day-to-day life, can be a mundane mediator of God's faithfulness. And who knows how that's all going to get tied together at the end of this story that we are all in together. Would you bow with me in prayer before we sing? God, I ask for you to open up our eyes to see how in mundane moments and even in moments where there is loss and suffering, that we would be able to see that you are holding it together and sustaining all things. Give us eyes to see that. Give us eyes to see where your redemptive activity is at work in those filler episodes of our life, where you are building our character, you're working in the character of other people around us. So give us the strength and the courage and the ability to see that you are always at work, and help us to participate in that work together. In your name, amen. Would you stand and sing together?